Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. President Trump on January 27th, 2017, signed an executive order barring travel from seven Muslim-majority nations, fulfilling a popular campaign promise and attracting scores of protests at airports across the country. 22 months later, a third iteration of the ban, which now affects travel from five Muslim-majority countries as well as Venezuela and North Korea, has been ruled constitutional by the U.S. Supreme Court. Political reporter Ted Hessen has covered the issue. He joins us by phone. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
The third iteration was the charm. How different is it from the first version?
Well, as you mentioned, it's the third time the White House has put forward a travel ban proposal. And, you know, some people would say it's a watered-down version of what happened originally. It's much clearer in who's impacted by the policy, and it's much more limited than the original policy that the White House put forward. If you remember when the travel ban initially came out back in January 2017, there was widespread confusion in airports around the world. And the reason for that was it wasn't clear if green card holders were exempted. It wasn't clear how exactly CBP, Customs and Border Protection officials, were to carry out the order. And in the more recent version, those things were spelled out more lucidly.
Yeah, how much clearer is it? I mean, is any confusion expected?
I think, well, I mean, first of all, the policy has been in effect since December. Mm-hmm. So that was the first signal that the Supreme Court might actually back it, because the Trump administration went to the Supreme Court and appealed nationwide injunctions that were blocking it and asked the court if it could move forward with it. And at first, they partially allowed it to go forward. And then by December, the court actually said it could be put into practice in full. So practically speaking, there shouldn't really be a change of policy now that the Supreme Court has approved the travel ban formally.
Two of the countries that were on the original ban were dropped off. What about those? Which ones were they, and why them?
Well, there are actually three countries.
Okay.
You're right. Two countries on the original ban, but over the course of this, three countries have been dropped. Iraq was on the original ban, and it was a surprise to some people because the country is an important ally, or should be an important ally, to the U.S. in the Middle East. And, you know, there were reports that there was some lobbying on behalf of people in the Iraqi government who thought that the country shouldn't be on that initial travel ban list. And it was dropped when the administration rolled out its second version of this policy in March 2017. There was also the country of Sudan was also on the list and was dropped. And then actually in the third version of the policy, Chad had initially been on here as well, another majority Muslim country. And Chad has since been removed from the current policy, and the government says that it now meets the vetting requirements that it's being asked.
What was the process of deciding which countries merited this ban?
I mean, according to the administration, there was a worldwide review of visa practices and vetting practices, and there were countries that were not up to par. And they said that some of these nations, and as we mentioned before, there are currently five countries on it, five majority Muslim countries, as well as Venezuela and North Korea, mm-hmm. So seven total. And they said that those nations weren't up to par when it came to vetting. I think critics of the policy said that, no, this was a continuation of the president's anti-Muslim rhetoric during his campaign. And, you know, rhetoric that he's actually continued to use in office as well.
What do we know about people who are in process to travel to the United States or to leave the United States to visit their home countries? I mean, has that all been sorted out because the policy has been in effect since December?
That's right. It should be. I mean, there shouldn't be any effective change as far as people who are traveling or anything along those lines. But what is interesting and what was cited in the Supreme Court opinion yesterday is that under the current version of this policy, there should be what's called a waiver that would allow people to go around the ban and enter the U.S., and that should be available to people whose families face a hardship if they can't be unified with them and who don't pose a threat. Now, a report last night from Reuters said that only 2% of applications for waivers were being granted, and then on top of that, it wasn't clear how many of those 2% even were issued visas eventually. It just meant that they got the waiver to apply for the visa.
As far as what Reuters reported, is that 2%, that's the policy number, or that so far that's all that's been granted?
They're saying that's what's been granted. There is no official number that should be granted or shouldn't be granted. Uh-huh. There's just criteria, which I mentioned before, mm-hmm. that says that it would cause a hardship to someone in the U.S. And that you don't pose a threat entering the country. And, you know, this is something you've heard immigration lawyers complaining about quite a bit. They're saying that their clients are asking for these waivers. They have, you know, circumstances that these lawyers really think fit the bill, but they're not hearing anything back, and they're either stuck in the queue, you know, not so much rejections, but just kind of haven't heard anything about what their waiver status.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. The U.S. Supreme Court has upheld President Trump's travel ban on seven countries, five of which are predominantly Muslim populations. We're going to hear from people who support the ban, people who oppose the ban coming up later in the program. We'll also hear from a refugee resettlement organization about what the immediate impact is on for their clients. My guest right now is Ted Hessen. He's an immigration reporter at Politico. What do you think, listeners? Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. I'm wondering if there's a sense about the political implications of this ban now that it's been approved and will be executed. Is there talk about that? Is this a good thing? It's a victory, but is it a good thing at this stage in the political cycle? Do you have thoughts about that, Ted Hessen?
You know, it's not clear entirely what it will mean for, say, the immigration debate that's happening here in Washington right now. There's so many different components to this, and the travel ban, which certainly caught lots of people's attention back in January 2017, has become a less central part of the debate of what's happening here. I mean, the live questions right now are families who are arriving at the southwest border. Will they be separated? President Trump has said that they should be kept together, but in a detained setting. But there are a lot of technical hurdles to doing that, not to mention some human rights groups say that it's not acceptable to keep kids in immigration jails. Mm-hmm. So I think, you know, that's really driving the conversation right now. And there are also so many other things that Congress is grappling with, including Dreamers who were brought to the country at a young age, who basically the president has ended the program that offered them legal status, and it's kind of running on a court order right now, but not clear what will happen with it.
Did the court take into consideration each country on its own volition, whether it posed the threat that the president has said it posed in, you know, signing this executive order?
That wasn't really the underpinning of this decision, and the decision essentially weighed whether the president has the power mm-hmm. To make these national security decisions, and they said that he did. They also made clear that they did not think that the order was the result of anti-Muslim sentiment. They didn't speak to whether it was an effective policy. As a matter of fact, Chief Justice John Roberts, who wrote the opinion, went as far as to say that this ruling was not a reflection of them saying, well, this is a good policy. So I think they weighed this as a national security interest, and that's the reason that it was approved.
And the people who are criticizing it, they're saying it represents religious discrimination. That is not the case, according to the court, because North Korea and Venezuela were added to it?
It wasn't just that specific reason. I think it was, again, going back to the president's power to take actions okay. of national security, and specifically to restrict entry of foreigners into the U.S. I mean, that was cited in the opinion that the president has had the power to do that in the past mm-hmm. and continues to have that power. Now, what you did see in the dissent to this, I mean, there were four of the court's more liberal justices were dissenting, and a faction of two of them, Justice Sonia Sotomayor and Ruth Bader Ginsburg, shared an opinion where a dissenting opinion, that is, mm-hmm. where they said that this was a reflection of anti-Muslim sentiment, and it actually echoes the decision in 1940s to intern Japanese Americans in internment camps during World War II.
North Korea and Venezuela, what about those processes don't meet muster with the U.S. when it comes to vetting travelers to the United States?
I mean, the administration hasn't shared too much information about what exactly the deficiencies are. I mean, you do have, in the case of North Korea, a government that's not cooperative with the U.S. on a range of issues, and in Venezuela, a government that's struggling to function and to provide basic services to the people in that country. I think both those things probably pose some challenges to vetting and communication with outside nations. Now, one thing worth noting is that while the ban is very broad for North Koreans, mm-hmm. in 2017, there were only about 60 or so North Koreans who got visas to the U.S., so a very tiny proportion of people who potentially could even hypothetically be affected by it. And then in the case of Venezuela, it's only applied to government officials and certain government officials, that is, and relatives of those officials. So again, a very small pool of people.
I've been thinking about the North Korea ban or being part of this ban as something that would please the government in North Korea, not bother them.
I mean, that could entirely be the case. I mean, as we all know, there's been some bargaining, and President Trump, of course, has met with the North Korean leader. Mm-hmm. But whether whether being on a sort of restricted list for the U.S. at this point, when it comes to immigration, really means much in the greater scope of things is hard to say. I mean, there's so many different kind of levers to pull against the country that are currently in action right now.
And then going back to the 2% or the waivers that have been reported that are available to people for purposes of hardship and who pose no threat, does that obviously Columbus is a college town. Ohio State University is here. Is it going to tend to be people like that who are studying here, that kind of a thing?
It's not clear whether that would qualify. I think, it's maybe a case that some immigration lawyers are making. Now, I should say, depending, each country under this proposal has a different set of restrictions against people who may come to the U.S. In the case of Iran, for instance, most immigrant and non-immigrant visitors are actually barred from coming to the U.S., but there is an exception for student visas. So, it would be open to students. And I think, there are some caveats for that, but coming back to these waivers, the real key component is whether there's a hardship on someone in the U.S. and whether or not you pose a threat. And presumably, they'd be able to vet students for the threat aspect, but whether they would meet the hardship criteria is another question.
Ted Hassan, thanks for joining us. I appreciate your time today.
Thank you very much.
That's Ted Hassan. He's an immigration reporter for Politico. Coming up, we're going to hear from two points of view about the ban that has been upheld by the Supreme Court, the president's ban on travel from seven countries, including five Muslim-majority countries. What do you think, listeners? 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. The nation's highest court has upheld an executive order by the president to ban travel to the United States by people from North Korea, Venezuela, Iran, Yemen, Syria, Libya, and Somalia. Advocates say this ban protects the U.S. from foreign threats. Opponents say the ban discriminates on the basis of religion. The national legal director for the ACLU told NPR's Nina Totenberg that the court fell short in its duty.
Today's decision is one of the court's historic failures to live up to its obligation to defend the rights of the most vulnerable from those who are most powerful.
Joining us by phone is the director of litigation at the Immigration Reform Law Institute, which supports the ban, Chris Hayek. Welcome to the show, Chris.
Thank you.
And joining us is the legal director for the Columbus chapter of the Council on American Islamic Relations, which opposes the ban, Roman Iqbal. Welcome back.
Thank you for having me.
Roman, many of the immigrants in Central Ohio affected by the ban, in the sense that they have been looking forward to reunification with some of their family members. What's the immediate effect that you know of?
I mean, people are just absolutely devastated. We had multiple calls from family members yesterday who have families outside the U.S., and they were really hoping that this ban would be lifted and they would be allowed to see their family members again, and the family members would be allowed to come into this country.
Are you surprised by the decision?
I was surprised, to be very honest. I did expect a close decision, but I did. My anticipation was that they would overturn at least most of the ban, if not the whole ban.
Well, it was the act. It was the presidential powers that were at issue here, right, Chris Hayek?
Yes. What struck me most is, from a legal perspective, is that this decision reveals very clearly that the president, under our law, is basically any president is basically an immigration restriction czar. He doesn't have broad power to expand immigration, but he has broad power to restrict it as he sees fit. And at most, rational basis review will be applied to his decision. But the court didn't even hold that rational basis was a requirement, or indeed that it could review the president's decision at all. It just said, we assume without deciding that we can review, rational basis review is the strongest level of review we can use, and Trump's order passes rational basis.
And you think that's good?
I think that that gets the Constitution right.
And as far as the presidential power to expand immigration from other countries, that doesn't cut both ways on Chris Hayek?
No, it doesn't.
What's the difference?
Well, the section of the law that the court relied on and the president relied on, section 1182F of the INA, says the president can suspend the entry of any class, all aliens, or any class of aliens whose entry he deems not in the national interest. And it doesn't say anything about the president being able to expand immigration. And there isn't any other provision that allows the president to greatly expand immigration.
Roman Iqbal, I mean, is it cut both ways? And you know, does one does not equal the other?
Yeah, I mean, I think I actually agree with the speaker who spoke before me that they have made turn that this opinion does turn the president into an immigration czar. And I anticipate that the president will now be using these new powers, which have been ratified by the court, to probably target the immigration from Central America. And we're already seeing a crisis on the border where the migrant crisis, especially with the children being separated from their families. And I see no reason why the president will not use these new powers to simply say that people from Central America can't come in here either, because the court basically said that as long as there is no discrimination in the text of the executive order, the president has the right to do it.
And the president has been laying the groundwork for that, perhaps in calling them a threat and the danger from these, you know, there's been a lot of that.
Right. Absolutely. I think it is. Well, no one can read into the mind of this president,
right.
But the way he has characterized these migrants, I would not be surprised. In fact, I almost expect the president now and to come out and say these are another category of threats to this country, and we will simply bar them from entry, and that resolving the problem on the border.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News, and we're talking about the U.S. Supreme Court upholding the travel ban, the first iteration of which was signed by the president in January 2017, just about a week after he took office. Now we're talking about the third iteration. Roman Iqbal, legal director of CARE in Columbus, and also Chris Hayek, attorney with the Immigration Reform Law Institute. If you have a question or comment, 614-292-8513. And Mike in Columbus, you're on the air.
Hi, I think it's really ironic that the Supreme Court decided this case not on the basis of anything that the president has said. He made many vehement statements based on the Muslim religion. But let's throw that out. That doesn't matter. What's just the merits of the case in terms of his powers? Mm-hmm. And yet 2 weeks ago, they decided on this masterpiece cake shop, the a fellow out in Colorado who felt it was against his religious beliefs to make a wedding cake. They threw that out because of a couple of relatively mild prejudicial statements made about
the technicalities,
religion.
Right?
Yeah. And so the previous statements made by that lower court they had to throw it out on that account because those statements, oh heavens, we can't have that. We can't have any statements against religion. I don't think they're consistent.
Chris Hyatt,
can I address that?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I think the difference is for the court that immigration is a foreign policy issue. It's part of foreign policy. And historically, and in the understanding of the court, the Establishment Clause either doesn't apply in foreign policy or it applies not as much. For example, we're now fighting a war against ISIS, and otherwise known as the Islamic State. And according to every test for what is a religion that the federal courts use, ISIS is in fact a religious group. So we're waging war on a religious group. If the Establishment Clause applied in foreign policy, that would be a problem. Somebody in ISIS in the United States could sue to enjoin the war and would, I guess, win. So the court's aware of this sort of thing, and so the Establishment Clause is not the same or may not apply at all beyond our borders or with respect to people trying to enter from abroad.
So then, Chris Hayek, do you agree with Roman Iqbal that the president could just expand this to Central America, Latin America, and people coming from those places?
I don't see much bar that. It might depend on whether he can do it politically, on whether there's a problem with legal immigrants from Central America. I mean, with the crisis on the border is illegal immigrants.
Right.
And people claiming asylum.
But if you're a czar, does it matter at a certain point?
Well, he has to follow the law and how he restricts. He can suspend entry, but that doesn't give him magical powers to enforce immigration laws and secure the border.
Okay.
I mean, much of the crisis on the border is illegal immigration driven.
Right.
And 1182F doesn't give him by itself power to do anything about that.
Roman Iqbal?
Well, you know, the same argument was being made about the countries which the president put on this ban list, Iran and Yemen and these countries. There has been no terrorism coming from these countries.
There's
either
a civil war in Yemen, a very an international crisis. But
right. And the larger point remains that this whole travel ban was based on a security predicate, that somehow these countries are not sharing information about the people who are applying for visas. And that is why these are being put on a list. But it has been a year and a half, and there really has been no evidence to suggest what exactly are they not sharing, what can they do to get off the list. And in fact, during the oral arguments, I believe it was Justice Sotomayor who basically said, are there other countries in the world who also do not meet this criteria of not sharing information who are not on the list? And they did not answer.
Chris Hayek, what about that?
Well, I think Neil Katyal, the attorney for the plaintiffs, put it best yesterday in a quote when he said, this is now a political issue. And he actually said, "What? Not everything that's constitutional is wise." And he called on Congress to overturn the travel ban. He's right. It is a political issue. I think it's always been a political issue. And the kinds of things that the other speakers just referred to are legitimate questions for the political arena.
President Donald Trump made comments after the Supreme Court announced it would hold the travel ban. I want to listen to one of those in particular.
We have to be tough and we have to be safe and we have to be secure. At a minimum, we have to make sure that we vet people coming into the country. We know who's coming in. We know where they're coming from. We just have to know who's coming here.
It sounds like he's talking about, Chris Hayek, the process by which we let people enter the country, not where they're coming from. The vetting process to get in the United States is pretty stringent, or do you disagree?
Well, he based the ban on need to improve the vetting from these particular countries because they didn't cooperate enough with us, or they didn't provide us enough information, or they didn't have the capacity to do so. And until the ban is conditional on that situation remaining. As soon as they are able to participate in our vetting processes adequately, then the ban will be lifted.
I think, unfortunately, that I understand the argument. That is the argument put forward by the government. But it seems to be some sort of a smokescreen. You know, there are various problems with this line of argument. For example, they also said they have waivers and that there is no complete ban, but actually some people get a waiver if
right.
they're eligible. But we know now that it's almost impossible to get a waiver.
Just about
2%. And if you call up your congressperson here in Columbus, they can't even answer the question how to get a waiver. So when they say, okay, once you improve your security procedures, well, we don't even know what those security procedures are. And more importantly, as I said earlier, we don't even know if there are other countries who also have a shortcoming on these procedures, but they are not on the list.
Mm-hmm.
So at some level, it is a political, and it is a ban which is based on politics and on a campaign promise more than anything else.
The question, though, before the court was, does the president have the power to do that?
Yes, the question was, does the president have the power? And number one, and number two, does that violate the Establishment Clause of not engaging in discrimination against a religion?
Justice Sotomayor compared the ruling to the 1944 Japanese internment case, Korematsu versus U.S., saying that as with the Korematsu case, the, quote, government invoked an ill-defined national security threat to justify an exclusionary policy of sweeping proportion. Chris Hayek, your thoughts about drawing a parallel between the two cases?
Well, it's not that close because it wasn't an exclusionary policy in Korematsu. Korematsu was the case challenging President Roosevelt rounding up Japanese American citizens and putting them into internment camps
mm-hmm.
for the duration of the war.
Saying because they were alleged to have pose a threat.
Right. They might harbor spies amongst them. And mm-hmm. So that was the justification. The Supreme Court said in that case, if we thought this was based on race, it would be flagrantly unconstitutional, and we'd overturn it. But it took the president at his word that it was based on national security. It wasn't about foreigners trying to enter the country from abroad. It was about locking up many of our own citizens in wartime, and it's never been thought that that was okay.
Yeah, Roman Iqbal.
Well, you know, I would not say that this is only about foreigners. These foreigners have family members here in this country who are American citizens. These foreigners want jobs in American institutions and American colleges. So I don't see this as a decision only affecting people who are non-U.S. citizens. This does affect U.S. citizens. U.S. citizens who have, you know, I'm an American citizen who has a mother abroad, who has a wife abroad, Ohio State University who wants to get a researcher from abroad. So I don't agree that this decision only impacts foreign people. It actually does impact American citizens.
I agree that it does. I also would say that there probably are American citizens who regard themselves as members of ISIS.
But I think that there is no connection here with ISIS, though, right? I mean, the president is not saying that all these people are part of a terrorist group, at least not yet.
Well,
No. Right. But the same reasoning that would allow plaintiffs to win here under the Establishment Clause by taking the Establishment Clause into this decision would allow these ISIS members to sue to enjoin any restrictions on their immigration or any or the war on ISIS itself.
But there would be a factual predicate based on security that why ISIS members should not be allowed to come in. But these universal global bans on these countries do not meet any factual predicate. And the only reason the Establishment Clause challenge survived in the court is because the court used the lowest possible standard. That is a rational review standard.
Right. It's I don't know if that's the only reason. But yes, it did use that standard. The factual predicate is something for the political branches to decide. Courts are not very good at making national security determinations.
Right, and the reason that the court did not go into looking whether the factual predicate was sound was because, again, they used a rational basis standard, which basically says that as long as the text itself does not include any language which suggests discrimination, you can get away with it regardless of what your actual belief is, regardless of what you say about what you're doing. As long as the text is facially neutral, you get away with it.
But
if the text on the ISIS and on an ISIS ban would just say ISIS, and that's a religious group. So that would be on its face, failing the rational basis.
Well, people just
dispute that ISIS is a religious group?
I don't think it doesn't appear to be one to most people, because we think of religions as being always being nice, like, you know, the Amish. But they're just as religious and just as much a religious group as the Amish, for example. And for the Amish, their religion tells them to be peaceful, and ISIS, their religion tells them to be violent.
Well, right, but there's Catholic people who blow up abortion clinics, and that doesn't make all Catholics enemies of the state.
You know,
but it's a distinct non-Islamic religious group that claims to be Islamic, but according to other mainstream Islam, it's not. It's sort of a heresy, and everybody in it belongs to the same religion, and the religion motivates everything they do.
Let me just say this. Let's say, without getting into the argument of the nature of ISIS, if the Supreme Court yesterday had overturned the ban, there is no reason to believe or to suggest that just because the Supreme Court had overturned this ban, they would then be compelled to allow ISIS to come in here. Because again, if the Supreme Court had overturned the ban yesterday and used a strict scrutiny standard, then yes, they could have gotten to the motives of the legislator, and that does not mean that would in any way, shape, or form result in a precedence which would, you know, give the right to an ISIS member to sue the U.S. government. I think that's not something which was anybody feared, but which would have come out of this decision if it had gone against the president.
I actually am not sure of that. I think that those sorts of considerations did influence the court, and also influenced the court on previous occasions, such as Mandel.
I think, again, to suggest that if the Supreme Court had overturned the ban because, let's say, they had used a strict scrutiny standard.
In other words, they looked at intent.
They looked at intent. Then that somehow translates into every religious terrorist group around the world not being given an ability to successfully sue the U.S. government is frankly just not, that's not feasible. That would not have happened.
Chris Hayek, I have to say goodbye to you. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Chris Hayek is an attorney with the Immigration Reform Law Institute, which supports the U.S. Supreme Court ruling on the president's ban of travel from North Korea, Venezuela, Iran, Yemen, Syria, Libya, and Somalia. Also with us, Roman Iqbal, thanks to you as well.
Thank you for having me.
Roman Iqbal is legal director for the Columbus chapter of the Council on American-Islamic Relations, which opposes the ban. We'd like to hear from our listeners, 614-292-8513. Or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. You're listening to All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. The Supreme Court this week upheld the Trump travel ban that restricts travelers from North Korea, Venezuela, Iran, Yemen, Syria, Libya, and Somalia. Five of those are Muslim-majority countries, and Somali immigrants in particular have a significant presence in central Ohio. Joining us to talk about the immediate impact on them and their families and others, refugees in the central Ohio area, is the Executive Director of Community Refugee and Immigration Services, Angie Plummer. Welcome back.
Thanks for having me, Ann.
So your office helps refugees resettle in Columbus in central Ohio. What does this travel ban mean now for you and the work that you do? I know it's been in place since December, so it's given you a little time, but what does it mean?
So the ban that was decided yesterday is for immigrant visas and visitors. There is a separate ban that a number of us would refer to as 4.0 that is not necessarily directly impacted by this decision, but we represent a lot of families doing family-based immigration petitions. So, you know, quite a few Somalis who have filed, who become U.S. citizens and applied for family members. And so many of those cases are now stuck. So it's explaining to, you know, a wife why her husband can't come now. There's a family that we resettled when the kids were young, they grew up, they've applied for their father now through the lawful process to apply for visas. This particular father is of Somali origin, is currently living in Malaysia, had an interview with the embassy in May, and he's now been denied a visa based on the proclamation. So he's now stuck. So it's explaining to that family, we don't know if and when he'll come. There is this waiver process, but I know you discussed earlier, nobody knows how it works. There's discrepancies in terms of even at the highest level, who has the authority to grant a waiver. It has to be in the national interest. How do you prove that? I mean, for this family, I would hope reuniting families is in the national interest. But can you make that kind of an argument for one particular family? So these are the challenges that we're facing. Is there truly a waiver process? You know, I don't know.
Well, they say about 2% have been waived, but I'm trying to figure out how you know what worked for them. Is that public record?
There's so little information.
Okay.
We've done congressional inquiries, so even our members of Congress don't understand the waiver process and can't get information about how it's supposed to work. I've seen several from different embassies, and they're even different. The forms that you're sent, they're different, so the process was different for different clients, so there's a lot of confusion. So there's not a standard process out there, and I feel like that was a misrepresentation made to the court by the administration's attorneys, that there was this waiver process, that you could do a case-by-case analysis, but so few people are being given them. And what are the rules? You know, we ought to know what the rules are and how to apply for one.
Aman in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Aman.
And first, I want to say I love your show. I almost every day, 2 hours listen. 1 hour is coming to work, 1 hour is go to work.
Thank you.
And I learn a lot from your show, to who to vote, who to watch for, who's serving our community or our city or our state. I all owe it to you and your show.
Thank you.
My question is regarding my mother-in-law. We applied 10 years ago to bring her to the United States, and my father-in-law was born passed away. And we got rejected when we appealed it, and then they rejected again because we didn't prove my wife is their mother and daughter. But we tried the situation and condition my mother-in-law is a breaking heart in Afghanistan.
So she never made it here?
She never made it. And we got a lawyer this time, about 4 or 5 months.
Okay, Aman, we've lost you. I'm sorry about that. It was hard to hear, but it sounds like jumped through a lot of hoops trying to get her mother from Afghanistan here. It's not one of the countries on the list. But what is the expectation now that the president has been granted these powers?
Well, we don't know if additional countries will be added to the list. It's hard to say. From the court's decision, it's certainly upholding very broad powers of the president in terms of immigration. And I probably obviously agree with much of what Justice Sotomayor said, in that it is completely ignoring the pain that is being inflicted on families, that this is happening to U.S. citizens. And it's not as visible as with the first travel ban when it was just rolled out without any thought. Over time, it was more carefully crafted. And now the devastation is happening at embassies, behind the scenes. It's in an office like mine where you have to explain to a client what's happening. So it's not the same kind of visibility as, say, the catastrophe at the border with the Central Americans right now. So it's become less visible, and it's sort of, you know, death by bureaucracy. So it's hard to say what will happen with a visa. I have clients who, again, what really bothers me is to hear the Attorney General talk about people coming here the right way. Well, you have people who are trying to come through all the prescribed processes, and the administration finds another way to block them because they found groups they determine undesirable, whether it's based on their religion or national origin, and they found a way to keep them out. So, you know, it's deeply disturbing, you know, what's happening.
What what are you recommending to people from these countries? Obviously, North Korea and Venezuela probably don't play strongly into your, you know, the paradigm of your office. But the other, I know Somalia is, you know, this is the second most populous Somalia, second largest Somali population in the country is in
Yes, I'm
Columbus.
Fairly certain we've never had a North Korean client.
Right?
I know I personally have not. Honestly, I think that was a distraction to even put them in the third travel ban. That was part of the design to say, well, it's not all Muslim countries. Look, we have the 60 or 8 people from North Korea, and we have the handful from Venezuela. So, but for Somalis, it's significant. And what was interesting to me is that Somalia was found to have met the obligation of providing the information that the federal agencies were requiring. But they said, well, but there's a significant terrorist presence in that country. So what does that mean? So for my client whose father is in Malaysia, the fact that he was born in Somalia precludes him from coming because there is a terrorist organization operating there, Al-Shabaab, you know, that our country is trying to help root out, that mm-hmm. many Somalis are trying to root out. So it's guilt by association. I think the administration has found another way to try to keep them out. And I paid attention on the campaign trail when the president specifically at a rally was calling out Somalis. And so I think it's very clear what the animus was from the very beginning. And you know, they've found a way to develop a ban that would accomplish the purpose to stir up the base.
When there's a ban like this, what does it do to funding or, you know, your funding stream? If there's a ban, do you still get funding or does that affect how you can afford to help people?
So this particular ban is of immigration related cases. Mm-hmm. So
instead of refugees,
would a person still apply for their parents, you know, in light of the ban? I think there'll be lots of discussions in upcoming days. You know, what is the strategy? Should you go ahead and apply and get in line? Because at some point there'll be a new administration. Go ahead and, you know, get that visa application filed. You know, I don't know. I don't know what the strategy is yet.
What is the cost to say, get a parent or a child here from another country like that?
Well, it depends on, you know, who you utilize as an attorney, what okay. the attorney fees would be. But there is a cost.
You have to have an attorney, though.
I would recommend someone have an attorney. You don't have to, but there are fees with immigration. I think it's $420 for the initial filing for one person. Then there are visa fees and affidavit of support fees. So let's say it's just $1,000-ish mm-hmm. for all of the various fees, plus attorney fees on top of that. And frequently there's DNA testing that's required. Mm-hmm. That's an additional expense. You know, so in most cases, the relationship has been established by DNA evidence already. You've already waited many years. There's a whole process of providing information. So I don't think this is really about providing documentation. This is about keeping people out.
What are people talking about today?
I think we're all really sad. I personally feel like I'm grieving. You know, words that you'd use at a funeral come to mind, profound sadness that this is the state of our country, that this has been allowed to happen here. I would agree and liken it to Korematsu and what's, you know, what I thought we'd set behind, you know, and while progress is, you know, you take a few steps forward and some steps back, all of that is irrelevant to the family who's separated now. And you think about parents and children being separated, what the emotional damage is to, you know, the child who's behind. In the newspaper today, they talked about a young Syrian man whose sister was left yeah. out. And that happens a lot in refugee circumstances where families have been separated and somebody might be behind. And so you follow the prescribed process. You wait and you wait and you wait. You may pay for DNA testing. And then, you know, the sister is stuck behind as the only one. And that's just one story of hundreds like hers, of people who are now being left behind because of this bad policy.
When they talk about the hardship waiver, what does that say to you? I mean, what kind of hardship are we talking about?
Well, again, that's the problem. I mean, what does that mean?
The person
mean?
Sitting in the cat seat is the one in the United States, not the person. The hardship has to be suffered by the person in the United States, right?
And it's not as simple as it would be a hardship to never live in the same country as your spouse.
But I'm thinking more, they must be thinking more of like a financial kind of hardship.
I wish I knew.
Yeah, okay. You don't even know that.
I wish I knew.
Huh. Are there concerns? I wonder if the low rate of waivers being granted is a function of staffing. Do you have any sense about whether or not the State Department is it the Department of Homeland Security that's adequately staffed to handle all of these?
I think it's very difficult to get information about staffing levels or much of any specific information from the State Department. I can tell you in the different context of cases I'm very familiar with family members who are in Uganda who have been waiting for years to come here through a legally prescribed process. Mm-hmm. So wait. These are even minor children. I finally thought it had been long enough, sent congressional inquiry through Senator Portman's office to learn, oh, in fact, we don't have room at the embassy for these files, so we're going to send them back to the U.S. Now the process has changed. Oh, we've decided we're going to handle these now out of Nairobi. So we'll have another delay while we send all the files to Nairobi, and then we'll come back to Uganda. So years go by while you're waiting for these kinds of things to happen.
How does an entity like Senator Portman's office respond to that kind of thing? What do they do?
They have very little. Currently, they have very little sway. I mean, we've been encouraging, particularly asking for answers to specific questions like, OK, how many circuit rides? This is what immigration has to go on and do interviews of people. How many are you going to do in the next quarter? How many staff will you send? Because that's what we're hearing in the refugee context is that they're interviewing only a handful of people. So if they're only going to interview 12 people, they can say, yes, we're doing a circuit ride, but it's not doing anything to help with the backlog.
We have an email from JT who writes, every country tries to apply the birds of a feather principle with respect to immigration. The U.S. is no exception. Your guest appears to be arguing against that principle. Would like to hear her take on my comment.
I don't know what that means.
I don't understand what that means either. I thought maybe you would. Every country tries to apply the birds of a feather principle. I don't know what they mean by that. Okay. I thought maybe it was something technical that Angie Plummer would know. We don't have time for any more calls. I'm sorry if you waited till the last minute. We will be picking up this conversation as in coming days and weeks and maybe years as things unfold for the immigrant and refugee communities from these countries. Of course, we're not really concerned about North Korea or Venezuela. Those are very narrow populations of people that are banned. The other countries, one of which is Somalia, does affect a lot of refugees in central Ohio. Angie Plummer, thanks for joining us to talk about it. I appreciate your time.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Angie Plummer is Executive Director of the Community Refugee and Immigration Services. We'll have a link to that on our website at WOSU.org/all sides if you want to learn more about what they do and how you can help. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.